Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 47, A Lion Caged. I'm your host Fraser, and today we delve deeper into the tumultuous era of the Scottish history of William I, following a pivotal event that reshaped the destiny of the nation. In our last episode, we journeyed through William's audacious invasion of England, a campaign spanning from September 1173 AD to the dramatic aftermath of the Battle of Alnwick in June 1174. This historical episode stands as a testament to ambition and the fragile nature of medieval power struggles. The Battle of Alnwick was a disastrous defeat for Scotland. Obviously, our king, King William I, decided to charge head first into a charging cavalry outnumbered at least 3-1. Anyway, today we'll explore the far-reaching repercussions of this decisive defeat and what it entailed for Scotland's future. The aftermath of Alnwick was a period of uncertainty, challenge and transformation for Scotland, a narrative that unfolds the resilience and the struggle of a nation and its leader. Imagine King William, a figure of strength and ambition, now finding himself in a situation he had least anticipated. His capture led to his journey to Newcastle, not as a conquering king, but as a prisoner in chains. This image is a stark contrast to the William we knew, the monarch who dared to challenge England. What thoughts might he have crossed his mind during this humbling journey? Was it regret, defiance, or a contemplative strategy for the future? This episode seeks to unravel the thoughts and plans of a king in captivity. The journey to Newcastle under the watch of Ralph de Glanville was just the beginning of William's ordeal. His subsequent transfer to Northampton and then Falaise in Normandy was a journey of reflection and strategisation. Scotland, in the wake of its king's capture, faced a dilemma. The loss at Alnwick wasn't just a defeat in battle, it was a critical blow to the nation's sovereignty and its standing among neighbouring realms. How did Scotland react to the absence of its king and the presence of Henry II's army on its soil? The answers to these questions are crucial in understanding the dynamics of medieval Scottish politics and society. The defeat and capture of William posed a fundamental question about his reign. Would he be removed as king for his failure like previous kings had been? Or would he, against all odds, pull Scotland through the dark times? Join me as we follow King William's journey as a king now caged, as we explore the depths of his trials and the resilience of Scotland. From his capture to the political manoeuvrings that ensued, we witness the unfolding of a story that is as much about a king as it was about a nation fighting for its identity and survival. Get ready, this will be a long one, probably longer than 30 minutes, but it's the least I can do for missing last week's episode. So let's embark on this journey together, exploring the twists and turns of Scottish history in the wake of the Battle of Alnwick. In the wake of the Battle of Alnwick in June 1174, the immediate aftermath for King William of Scotland was a journey marked not only by physical displacement, but also by a profound psychological ordeal. His capture led to a forced journey under the watchful eyes of Ralph de Glanville, a journey that would see him traverse through various lands, each step a reminder of his dramatic fall from power. As William was escorted to Newcastle, the king, once the epitome of Scottish sovereignty, found himself in a vulnerable and humiliating position. This journey to Newcastle, far from the triumphant marches of a sovereign, was a procession of defeat. Shackled and under close guard, William's thoughts during this time would have been a complex tapestry of regret, contemplation, and perhaps a relentless search for redemption. He would have pondered the missteps that led to his capture, the fate of his kingdom now leaderless, and the uncertainty of his future. It is conceivable that he grappled with the feelings of betrayal, not just by fate, but perhaps by his own overreaching ambition. You know, he did decide to try and charge down 600 English knights with only 60 of his men. So, in reality, is this something that was going to happen anyway? Was his headstrong approach too much? Following his brief sojourn in Newcastle, William's journey continued to Northampton. This leg of the journey likely offered him time to reflect on the broader geopolitical implications of his capture, as he heard about further rumblings about what was going on in Scotland. The final leg of William's journey took him across the English Channel to Falaise in Normandy. This journey was not just a physical relocation, but a transition into the heart of the Angevin power under the control of King Henry II of England. Remember, the Angevin Empire under King Henry II's leadership was mainly based in France in terms of like the court. England was kind of a bit more of a subsidiary to Henry, hence why the revolts were happening in the first place, to be honest. Anyway, Fallus, a fortress steeped in Norman history, would have been a poignant reminder of the formidable power of the English crown, a power that now held William's fate in its hands. At Fallus, William found himself in a foreign land. Far from his realm and subjects, this distance from Scotland would have been more than geographic. It was a chasm that separated him from his authority and influence. It is likely that during his time in Fallus, William experienced a profound sense of isolation and helplessness, a king without a kingdom, a ruler without sovereignty. There he met Henry II of England, someone who would not be too happy with how William took advantage of the situation that landed on Henry's doorstep. In the grand halls of Fallus, a fortress renowned for its strength and historical significance to the Normans, the atmosphere would have been charged with a mix of solemnity and unspoken tension. For William, this meeting was a confrontation with his captor, a ruler whose authority he had challenged, leading to his current predicament. For Henry II, it was an opportunity to assert his dominance and to take terms to a king who was now effectively his prisoner. As the two monarchs faced each other, the contrast in their circumstances would have been stark. Henry, secure in his power and authority, faced a defeated and captive William. The psychological impact on William, stripped of his royal autonomy and brought before Henry in chains, would be profound. This was a moment that tested not just his resolve as a king, but his dignity as a sovereign. The dialogue between them, though not recorded in detail, would have revolved around the conditions of William's captivity and the future of Scotland under English influence. Henry, known for his political acumen and strategic mind, would have likely approached the conversation with a blend of sternness and calculated diplomacy. He would have been aware of the significance of this moment, not just for asserting his control over William, but for sending a clear message to the broader realm about the consequences of challenging his authority. For William, this meeting was a moment of reckoning. He was in a precarious position, needing to negotiate not only for his freedom, but also for the autonomy of his kingdom. His responses and demeanour would have been a delicate balance between showing submission to secure leniency and maintaining a semblance of royal dignity. It was a tightrope to walk between the personal humiliation of a defeat and the overarching need to safeguard Scotland's interests. During these discussions, though, Henry II made the decisive move to send an English army to occupy Scotland. This strategic decision was not merely a response to the capture of a rival monarch, but a calculated effort to capitalise on Scotland's vulnerability and assert English dominance in the region. The occupation of Scotland by English forces represented a significant shift in the power dynamics between the two kingdoms. It was a clear demonstration of England's military strength and its willingness to exert direct control over Scottish affairs. For Henry II, this was an opportunity to solidify his authority and influence over his northern neighbour, exploiting the absence of the Scottish king to impose a form of indirect rule over Scotland. Scotland's reaction to the loss of the Battle of Alnwick and the subsequent English occupation was marked by a mix of shock, dismay, and the sense of urgency to respond to the unfolding crisis. Our regent in the land, the steward of Scotland, decided, you know, this defeat of Alnwick was not just a military setback, it was a blow to the nation's pride and challenge to its sovereignty. He didn't fight back. He bent the knee. In the immediate aftermath of Alnwick, there was likely a sense of disbelief and confusion among the rest of the Scottish nobility as well. The sudden absence of their king, coupled with the swift English occupation, would have created a power vacuum and a crisis of leadership. Scottish nobles faced the reality of English troops on their soil, and that would have been forced to make some difficult choices between resistance and submission. The occupation by Henry's army was met with a varied response across Scotland. You know, this period likely saw a mix of diplomacy, manoeuvrings, local resistance, and the efforts to maintain some semblance of normality under the extraordinary circumstances. The Celtic nobles of the north certainly weren't happy with this occupation, whereas the Norman nobles accepted it more due to the close ties they had with England. As King Henry II and William discussed the treaty, The Treaty of Alluce was then signed in 1174. It was a watershed moment in Scottish history, reshaping the political landscape of Scotland under relation to England. This treaty was not merely a diplomatic agreement, but a drastic realignment of Scotland's status as a sovereign nation, following the capture of Henry. Central to the Treaty of Alluce were the terms that deeply impacted Scotland's sovereignty and financial stability. The most significant stipulation was William's recognition of Henry II as his feudal superior. This acknowledgement was a stark departure from Scotland's long-standing tradition of an independent kingship. By accepting Henry as his overlord, William was not just surrendering his personal autonomy, but also subjugating Scotland to English sovereignty. This move fundamentally altered the relationship between the two kingdoms, placing Scotland in a position of subordination to England. Another crucial aspect of the treaty was the financial obligation imposed on Scotland. To secure his release and regain control over his kingdom, William agreed to pay a hefty ransom for the cost of the English army's occupation of Scotland. This cost was warranted at 40,000 Scottish marks, equivalent to approximately 26,000 at the time, a considerable sum that reflected the severity of William's situation and the extent of English control. To fulfil this obligation, the head of the Stuart dynasty and steward of England was asked by William to levy taxes on his subjects, a decision that would have likely placed a significant burden on the Scottish populace both financially and societally. Furthermore, the Treaty of Alluce had profound ecclesiastical implications. It placed the Scottish Church under the jurisdiction of the Church of England. If you remember, this was something that the Scottish Church tried to fight against in previous episodes. Anyway, this condition was not just a religious formality, but symbolised a deeper erosion of Scottish independence. The Church, an integral part of medieval society, was a bastion of national identity and autonomy. By subjugating the Scottish Church to English authority, the treaty further diminished Scotland's independence. If we now examine the Treaty of Alluce more closely, the exact text reveals the profound nature of King William's submission to Henry II. Language used in the treaty is stark and unambiguous, outlining the new relationship between Scotland and England. The treaty begins with a clear declaration of the agreement. "This is the agreement and treaty which William, King of Scots, made with his Lord King Henry, the son of Maud, the Empress." This introductory clause sets the stage for the drastic shift in power dynamics, identifying Henry II not just as a king, but as William's Lord King, a title signifying William's subservience. The treaty continues. "William, King of Scots, has become liegeman of Lord King Henry, against every man in respect of Scotland and in respect of all other lands, and he has done fealty to him as his liege lord, as all other men of the Lord King are wont to do." This passage is critical as it explicitly states that William, in his capacity as King of Scots, is now the liegeman of Henry II. The use of "against every man" underscores a totality of this allegiance, indicating that William's loyalty to Henry subserves any other commitments, whether within Scotland or in his other lands. Furthermore, the treaty specifies that William has performed the traditional acts of fealty and homage to Henry II, rituals that were deeply symbolic in the medieval feudal society. These acts were public demonstrations of William's position as a subordinate to Henry, further solidifying the change in their relationship. The treaty also contains a clause that is particularly telling. "Likewise, he has done homage to Henry the King, son of King Henry, saving only the fealty which he owes to the Lord King, his father." This section reveals a layered nature of William's vassalage, extended not just to Henry II, but also to his son, Henry the Young King. This clause ensured that Henry would and young King Henry, so King Henry II's heir, would still be the overlord of Scotland even after King Henry II's passing. For listeners interested in a deeper dive into the historical and political nuances of this pivotal treaty, I'll be conducting a full reading of the Treaty of Alluce at the end of this episode. This reading will provide a comprehensive understanding of the treaty's terms and its significance in the broader context of Scottish and English history. Henry II's ability to defeat his sons and wife in what was known as the Revolt of 1173 and 1174, a series of rebellions by his children and their mother, Eleanor of Aquitaine, demonstrated his formidable political and military acumen. These rebellions were quelled through a combination of military might, strategic alliances, and Henry's skillful negotiations, solidifying his position as a powerful monarch in Western Europe. In relation to this, this gave King Henry II the confidence to put more clauses in the Treaty of Alluce. The treaty's provisions extended beyond the mere acknowledgement of fealty by the Scottish king. It encompassed various aspects of Scottish sovereignty, including the nobility, clergy, and judicial proceedings. The agreement effectively diminished the power and autonomy of the Scottish monarchy, making the King of Scots, his nobles, and even the clergy answerable to the English crown. One of the most striking aspects of the treaty was that the Scottish nobles, alongside their king, were now required to owe fealty to Henry II and his heirs, against all men. This clause signified a profound shift in allegiance. Traditionally, the Scottish nobles' primary loyalty was to their own king. However, under the treaty, their loyalty to the English king superseded their allegiance to William. This realignment of fealty was not only diminishing for the Scottish king's authority, but also created a potential conflict of interest for the nobles. Should William retract or violate the terms of the treaty, the nobles were obliged to intervene on Henry's behalf, effectively pitting them against their own monarch if necessary. This provision marked an unprecedented direct intervention in the relationship between the Scottish king and his subjects. Something else that Henry II required was a demonstration of English control over Scotland. The treaty required the handing over five strategic castles. These were Roxburgh, Berwick, Jedburgh, Edinburgh, and Stirling. These castles were to be garrisoned by English soldiers, with the cost borne by Scotland. This not only represented a loss of territorial control, but also a significant financial burden on the Scottish kingdom. The treaty also detained responsibilities regarding fugitives. England was granted the authority to try Scottish fugitives, while Scotland was required to hand over English felons. This provision further underscored Scotland's subservient position, as it allowed English legal judiciary to extend into Scottish affairs. To ensure the widespread adherence to the treaty's terms, barons and bishops who were not present during the signing were required to perform the same liege homage. Additionally, to secure the treaty's enforcement, hostages, including heirs or nearest kin of nobles and bishops, were forced to be turned over to the English. This requirement served as a guarantee of compliance, holding the most prominent Scottish families directly accountable for the treaty's terms. William's position as a prisoner meant that his negotiation of the treaty was a less than a matter of diplomacy exchange, and more of an imposition of terms by Henry. The public act of submission took place in a setting laden with historical and political significance, in the Church of St. Peter in York. This location, far from the Scottish realm, in front of the English kingdom's chief men, highlighted William's subjugation status. This presence of William's own nobles, clergy, knights, and freeholders added to the gravity of the moment. They bore witness to their own king's public humiliation, and a spectacle that underscored the shift in power dynamics. William and his brother, in an act laden with symbolic defeat, sealed a document in this public form. The additional embarrassment came from the treaty being read aloud, ensuring all present understood the depth of Scotland's submission. This public reading was not just a formality, it was a deliberate act to cement Henry's triumph and William's capitulation in the minds of both the English and Scottish attendances. Two drafting details in the treaty particularly stand out for their symbolic importance. Firstly, the consistent reference to Scotland as a land rather than a kingdom was a subtle but powerful demotion of Scotland's status. This linguistic choice anticipated the tactics used by Edward I over a century later, diminishing the perception of Scotland as an independent kingdom. By referring to Scotland merely as a land, the treaty subtly undermines its status as a nation equal in stature to any other European kingdoms. Secondly, the contrasting titles used for Henry II and William was stark. Henry was referred to as the Lord King, a title that conveyed the supreme authority and sovereignty. In contrast, William was merely King of the Scots, a title that, while still regal, placed him in a visible subordinate position to Henry. This distinction in titles was a clear indication of the hierarchy established by the treaty, with Henry positioned as the superior overlord. The treaty's framework did not explicitly define the relationship between Scotland and England as a feudal one. Scotland was not described as a fief, nor was it said to be held or had by the King of England. Instead, Henry was elevated to a position akin to a high king, with William allowed to reign as King of Scots only under the condition of acknowledging his ultimate dependence on Henry's overlordship. So, with the Treaty of Falloux signed, Henry II obviously had returned to Scotland. He had done the public act of swearing fealty to Henry II at York Castle in 1175. This period enforced English overlordship and the visible diminution of the king's authority. And it did not go unchallenged within Scotland. One of the most significant reactions to the treaty was the revolt in Galloway. The Galloway Revolt was started by Uhtred of Galloway and his brother Gilbert. The reasons for this revolt were complex, rooted in both the local dynamics of Galloway and the broader context of Scottish subjugation under the Treaty of Falloux. Galloway at this time was a region with a distinct identity and a degree of autonomy within Scotland, as we've known from the past episodes. The Galloway lords had a history of asserting their independence and often had a strained relation with the Scottish crown. The submission of King William and the treaties of the Treaty of Falloux, which placed Scotland under English overlordship, were seen as an unacceptable imposition by the fiercely independent Galloway lords. To them, the treaty was not just a matter of national humiliation, but also a direct threat to their local authority and traditional rights. The Galloway Revolt was therefore a response to a multiple of grievances. It was fueled by the desire to resist the encroaching English influence and to protect regional autonomy against the perceived weakness of the Scottish crown. The revolt was a manifestation of the discontented and the unrest that the Treaty of Falloux had stirred within Scotland, highlighting the challenges William faced in maintaining control and unity in a kingdom now fractured by external subjugation and internal dissent. Uhtred of Galloway and his brother Gilbert were prominent figures in the history of medieval Scotland, particularly known for their role in this revolt. They belonged to a powerful family in Galloway, a region in southwestern Scotland. Uhtred, the elder of the two, was a Lord of Galloway, a title that carried significant authority and influence in the region. His brother Gilbert also held considerable power and was instrumental in the revolt against the Scottish crown and English influence in Scotland. The Galloway family had established a king of regional dominion, which was often at odds with the Scottish king's centralising policies. Uhtred did lead an army in the invasion. He did join, if you remember, King William in the invasion. But as soon as King William was captured, Uhtred rode back to Galloway, hearing of the king's defeat and knowing what would become of it. He rode back to his lands, ready to stir the revolt. Once King William signed the Treaty of Falloux in 1174, Uhtred and Gilbert saw an opportunity to assert their autonomy and resist the encroaching power of the Scottish crown, especially the Davidonian Revolution. Now weakened and compromised by English overlordship, the treaty was deeply unpopular in many parts of Scotland, perceived as a national humiliation as a betrayal of Scottish sovereignty. For the fiercely independent lords of Galloway, this was an intolerable situation. Seizing upon the unrest and dissatisfaction caused by the treaty, Uhtred and Gilbert led a revolt that was marked by significant violence against the Normans and English in their land. This resistance was not just a political rebellion, but also had elements of ethnic and cultural conflict. The Normans, who had established themselves in parts of Scotland following the Norman conquest of England and the Davidonian Revolution as we know, were seen as foreign oppressors, and their presence was resented in regions like Galloway. Uhtred and Gilbert's campaign against the Normans and English in Galloway involved the slaughter of many settlers and soldiers. This violence was a clear message of defiance against the Scottish crown's subservience to English authority and an assertion of Galloway's regional independence. The brutality of these actions also reflected the deep-seated animosity towards foreign influence and control. The actions of Uhtred and Gilbert in Galloway were a significant part of the wider resistance in Scotland to the Treaty of Alluce. Their revolt highlighted the challenges that William would face in maintaining control over his kingdom now that he's returned. The Galloway Revolt was emblematic of an episode in struggle for Scottish autonomy and regional independence. During the massacres, they also swiftly moved to expel the king's bailiffs and guards and turned against the English and French settlers in the region as we know. This action was a direct response to the perceived weakness of the Scottish monarchy. The brothers' forces besieged, captured and destroyed the defences and castles established by the king in Galloway, eliminating any symbols of the king's authority in their domain. However, the narrative takes a dramatic turn, revealing a deep rift between the brothers. While it was initially believed that both Uhtred and Gilbert were united in resistance, it became clear that Gilbert was actively opposing the Scottish crown. Uhtred, in contrast, found himself besieging Gilbert's son Malcolm. And this makes more sense. Uhtred did serve in the court for William. He did fight in the invasion. He did lead an army in the invasion of England. So he did seem like William's man in Galloway. So really, I think we can put it down to Gilbert being the one who wanted to stir the pot and get Galloway independent, and Uhtred was only really stirring the pot to get rid of England overlordship. So in short, Uhtred is against England, whereas Gilbert is against both Scotland and England. Anyway, Uhtred's capture and brutal mutilation by his nephew underscored the intense familial and political strife within Galloway. Gilbert's actions during this period were bold and almost altered the course of British history. He sought to establish a direct relationship with King Henry II, bypassing the Scottish monarchy, therefore proving the point that Gilbert wanted Galloway to be independent from Scotland, whereas Uhtred just wanted England to be removed from Scotland and keep his subservient nature to the Scottish crown. Anyway, Gilbert offered Henry a significant one-off payment and a yearly tribute in exchange for removing Galloway from Scottish servitude. This request was investigated by a delegation led by Roger de Hoveden and Robert de Hoxe. However, the discovery of Uhtred's fate, who was Henry's cousin, led to the rejection of Gilbert's proposal. This rejection was a pivotal moment, as it prevented a potential realignment of allegiances and power structures in the region. Once William returned to Scotland, it complicated matters further for Gilbert. He was forced to reconcile with the two kings, travelling to England in 1176 and paying a hefty fine, and handing over his sons as hostages to ensure his further compliance. Gilbert's reign in Galloway was characterised by his hostility to the Scottish kings and his resistance to Norman influence, maintaining a strong Gaelic following. This stance made him popular in Galloway, but alienated him from the Scottish monarchy. King William, in turn, cultivated the loyalty of Uhtred's sons, Ronald, using him strategically in the ongoing struggle for control over Galloway. Uhtred was one of William's greatest men. In the invasion, Uhtred was there in every battle. Uhtred was a strong man for William, maybe potentially a friend. So this explains the tensions that were coming. The tensions between Gilbert and William remained high throughout the 1180s, with Gilbert known for his raids into eastern Galloway controlled by Scotland. Once Gilbert died in 1185, however, while still at war with William, his sons, still in Henry's custody, significantly changed the political landscape. It eased the way for William to install Ronald as Gilbert's successor, thereby reasserting his influence over Galloway and allowing Uhtred's sons, obviously Uhtred's now dead, Uhtred's sons to become the rulers of Galloway, paying back his loyalty, Uhtred's loyalty, to King William. This series of events highlights the turbulent and often violent nature of the politics in Scotland as we know. From the king's perspective, the revolt in Galloway led by Gilbert was not just a regional uprising. It was a direct challenge to his authority. Him killing Uhtred was also personal. The conflict between Uhtred and Gilbert provided an opportunity for William to exploit these divisions and weaken the revolt from within. By supporting his friend, Uhtred's son, Ronald, William aimed to install a leader in Galloway who was more amenable to his rule. This move was a classic example of medieval power politics, where familial divisions were often used to an advantage by savvy monarchs. Once Ronald was installed, Uhtred was avenged. Yes, the king had to manoeuvre some armies and play a bit more of a diplomatic game in the future to make sure Galloway became fully subservient again, but regardless, this allowed Uhtred's lineage to carry on and Gilbert's to die off. One significant move in the revolt as well was the construction of a castle at Dumfries by William. This castle was not just a military installation, it was a symbol of royal power and a strategic tool to maintain control over the region. Ronald was installed at the castle of Dumfries, and the castle served multiple purposes. It acted as a deterrent against further rebellion and a base from which Ronald and royal forces could operate a tangible representation of the Scottish crown authority in Galloway. Its construction would have been a clear message to the Galloweians, an often potential rebellious region that the king was capable of and willing to enforce his rule. So sadly, Uhtred, our friend of William I, is dead. His obviously brother Gilbert would later die, but Uhtred's son would come to rule Galloway. And I think this gives William a bit of closure. Yes, his friend may have died. Yes, his friend may have complicated things trying to revolt to get rid of England as an overlord. But I think William understood Uhtred's intentions and respected them. Whereas Uhtred's brother Gilbert didn't want or like William. He wanted his own independence from Scotland, hence why he tried to double deal with the English king. In 1175, amidst the backdrop of internal strife, William and his brother David undertook a significant military campaign in the northern part of the kingdom. They led a force into Eastern Ross, a strategic move aimed at bolstering the Scottish authority in a region that was prone to external threats, particularly from the Kingdom of Norway. As part of this campaign, William established two more castles, one at the Black Isle at Eriador and at the other at Dunkeith, near the mouth of the Cromer Firth, opposite Cromery. Fortifications were strategically located in between the different firths in the region, and this significantly allowed Scotland to control the proximity to the Norse-controlled territories. The primary aim of constructing these castles was to discourage the Norse Earls of Orkney from expanding their influence beyond Caithness, a northern region of Scotland. By establishing a strong military presence in Easter Ross, William sought to deter any Norse incursions and assert Scottish sovereignty over this frontier region. The construction of these castles was a clear demonstration of William's intent to protect his kingdom's borders and maintain its territorial integrity. And with these castles being constructed, we can safely say the Davidonian Revolution is complete. William is doing what a Norman king would do, building castles. In 1181, however, another significant revolt shook the stability of William's reign. This uprising was led by Donald MacUlmun, a descendant of King Duncan II. Rest in peace. Donald's claim to the Scottish throne through his royal lineage posed a direct challenge to William's authority. Donald's revolt saw him briefly take over the region of Ross, a significant area in the north of Scotland. His ability to assert control over Ross demonstrated the ongoing vulnerability of William's rule and the simmering discontent among certain factions within Scotland. The fact that Donald, with his royal lineage, could muster enough support to take control of a region highlighted the fractured nature of the Scottish politics and complex web of loyalties and claims to the throne. The uprising led by Donald was part of a broader pattern of revolts as we know, which would impact Scotland throughout the 12th century. Revolts against William during his reign were driven by a combination of factors, reflecting the complex socio-political landscape of medieval Scotland. Each area had its unique reasons for rising up, but some common themes can be identified. In various regions like Galloway and Ross, a significant factor behind the revolts was a desire for local autonomy and resistance to the Davidonian Normanisation and centralisation. These areas had long-standing traditions of self-governance and distinct cultural Celtic identities. They resisted the centralising efforts of the Scottish monarchy, viewing it as a threat to their traditional rights and local governance. The Treaty of Alluce, which implied increased English influence and therefore Norman influence of Scottish affairs, exacerbated these tensions, leading to the revolts that were merely not only about asserting local autonomy, but also about preserving their unique identities. We know King William responded to the revolts during this reign with a combination of military actions, diplomacy, and strategic measures. His responses varied depending on the specific circumstances of each revolt, but some general strategies can be identified. In the face of revolts, William often relied on the use of his army to suppress the uprisings. Military campaigns were launched to regain control over the rebellion regions. These campaigns involved the deployment of royal forces to confront and subdue the rebels. The exact nature of these military actions varied, but sieges, battles, and skirmishes were common components of William's efforts to maintain authority. And the fact that some of the revolts persisted until 1187 underscores the enduring nature of the challenges William faced during his reign. These revolts required ongoing attention, resources, and strategic planning to manage. So, we will leave King William in the year 1181, facing the ongoing challenges of revolts and striving to regain the loyalty of his kingdom. We can anticipate that his reign will be marked by significant struggles and far-reaching consequences. The Treaty of Alluce, which he is compelled to sign, has reshaped the dynamics of Scotland's relationship with England and introduced a new era of subservience to the English crown. The revolts that have erupted in various regions signalled a deep-seated discontent and resistance to William's rule, reflecting the complex political landscape of medieval Scotland. These challenges will continue to test his leadership and authority, and the road to restoring stability and loyalty in his kingdom will be long and arduous. Furthermore, as we look ahead to the coming centuries, it becomes evident that the ramifications of the Treaty of Alluce will extend far beyond William's reign. The treaty's provisions, which established English dominance over Scotland, will have an enduring effect on the relationship between the two kingdoms, setting the stage for the future conflict and power struggle of the independence wars. As we conclude this episode on the aftermath of William's defeat to England and the far-reaching consequences of the Treaty of Alluce, we hope you have found this journey through Scotland's history both enlightening and intriguing. The events we've explored shed light on a pivotal period in Scotland's past, where challenges and choices would shape the nation's destiny. With the revolts that erupted in various regions of Scotland now quelled, King William faces a challenging road ahead. His hopes of regaining leverage and stability in his kingdom will require steadfast determination and strategic manoeuvring. In our next episode, we will delve into the next stage of King William's life as he embarks on a quest to bring Scotland back to independence. This journey will intertwine with the political dynamics of a time, including conflicts between kings and popes. Additionally, we'll explore William's family life, including his forced marriage to a bride chosen by Henry II, unravelling the personal aspects of his life against a backdrop of political intrigue. We invite you to join us in this upcoming episode of the History of Scotland podcast, where we continue to unravel the rich tapestry of Scotland's past. Our podcast is released weekly, with next episode set to air next week as part of our commitment to provide engaging historical content. To stay updated and connected with our community, please follow us on Twitter, or X as it's now known as, at the History of SE1, that is, at the History of SE1, or visit our Facebook page at the History of Scotland podcast, which is now over 50 members. I think it's actually on 62, which is insane. Your support and feedback are greatly appreciated, and thank you to the nice comments that have been left on the Facebook page by fans. Really appreciate reading those. Please consider leaving a review on your preferred podcast platform as well. Our podcast is accessible on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podbean, and many other popular podcasting sites. Look forward to sharing more captivating stories from Scotland's history with you in the episodes to come. As we bid farewell for now, we wish you a wonderful week ahead and look forward to your continued presence in our historical journey. To listen to the full reading of the Treaty of Alluce, wait until after the credits are done. So, until then, guys, stay safe, and I'll catch you all on the next one. Peace. As mentioned, here is a full reading of the Treaty of Alluce. William, King of Scotland, has become liegeman of the Lord King against every man in respect of Scotland and in respect of all his lands, and he has done fealty to him as his liege lord, as all other men in their Lord King are wont to do. Likewise, he has done homage to Henry the King, the son of King Henry, saving only the fealty which he owes to the Lord King his father. And all the bishops and abbots and clergy of the kings of Scots and their successors shall do fealty to Lord King as they do to their liege lord, in the same way as the Lord King's other bishops are wont to do. They shall likewise do fealty to Henry the King his son and to his heirs. And the King of Scots, and David his brother, and his barons and other men have granted to the Lord King that the Scottish Church shall make submission to the English Church as it ought to do, and it won't do in the time of the Lord King's predecessors, King of England. Likewise, Richard, Bishop of St. Andrews, and Richard, Bishop of Dunkeld, and Geoffrey, Abbot of Dunfermline, and Herbert, Prior of Coldingham, have granted that the English Church should have such rights in Scotland as it ought to have, that they will themselves not oppose any of the rights of the English Church. And they have pledged themselves in respect of this admission by performing liege fealty to Lord King and Henry his son. Likewise, the other Scottish bishops and clergy shall do by a pact made between the Lord King and the King of Scots and David his brother and his barons. The earls also and barons and such other men holding land from the King of Scots as the Lord King Henry may select shall also do homage to the Lord King as against all men, and shall swear fealty to him as their liege lord, in the same way as other men are wont to do. And they shall do the same to Henry the King his son and to his heirs, saving only the fealty which they owe to the Lord King his father. Likewise the heirs of the kings of Scots and his barons and all of his men shall do liege homage to the heirs of the Lord King against all other men. Further, the King of Scots and his men shall not receive, either in Scotland or in any of his other lands, any exile from the lands of the Lord King, who has been expelled therefrom by reason of felony, unless he wishes to justify himself in the court of the Lord King Henry, and to submit to the judgment of his court. Otherwise, the King of Scots and his men shall take such a one as quickly as they can and bring him to the Lord King, or to his justicars, or to his bailiffs in England. Again, if there comes to England any fugitive expelled as a felon from the lands of the Kings of Scots, he shall not be received in the lands of the Lord King Henry unless he wishes to justify himself in the court of the King of Scots and to submit to the judgment of his court. Otherwise, such a one shall be delivered to the men of the King of Scots by the bailiffs of the Lord King wherever he is found. Further, the men of the Lord King shall continue to hold the lands which they held, and which they ought to hold from the Lord King, and from the kings of Scots from their men. And the men of the kings of Scots shall continue to hold the lands which they held, and which they ought to hold from the Lord King from his men. In order that treaty and pact with the Lord King and Henry the King, his son and his heirs, may be faithfully kept by the Kings of Scots and his heirs, the Kings of Scots has delivered to the Lord King the castle of Roxburgh, and the castle of Berwick, and the castle of Jedburgh, and the castle of Edinburgh, and the castle of Stirling to be held by Lord King Henry at his pleasure. And the King of Scots shall pay for the garrison of these castles out of his own revenue at the pleasure of Lord King Henry. Further, in the pledge of aforesaid treaty and the pact the King of Scots has delivered to the Lord King, his brother David as a hostage, and also the following: Earl Duncan, Earl Waldwin, Earl Gilbert, the Earl of Angus, Richard de Morville, the Constable, Nis son of William, Richard Comyn, Walter Corbett, Walter Allard, John de Vales, William of Lindsay, Peter Gilaville, Philip of Valmore, Robert Frembert, Robert de Mulville, Hugh Clifford, Hugh Raffold, Walter Burke, William de Lay, William de Mormont. When the castles have been handed over, they shall William, King of Scots, and David his brother be released. And again, after the castles have been handed over, the earls and barons aforesaid shall be released. But only each one has delivered his own hostage, to wit his legitimate son, if he has one, or otherwise his nephew or nearest heir. Furthermore, the King of Scots and his barons have foresaid have guaranteed that with good faith and without evil intent and without excuse, they will see to it that the bishops and barons and other men of their land, who were not present when the King of Scots made his pact with the Lord King Henry and with Henry the King his son, shall do the same leech homage and fealty as themselves have done. And the barons and men who were not present at this agreement shall give such hostages as the Lord King Henry shall determine. Further, the bishops, earls and barons aforesaid have convened with Lord King Henry and with Henry the King, his son, that is, the King of Scots shall be by any mischance default in his fealty to the Lord King and his son, and shall thus break aforesaid agreement, that they, the aforesaid bishops, earls and barons, will hold to the Lord King Henry as to their liege lord against the King of Scots and against all men hostile to the Lord King. And the bishops shall place the land of Scotland under interdict until the King of Scots returns to the Lord King in his fealty. The Lord, the King of Scots and David his son, and all aforesaid barons and liegemen of the Lord King Henry and Henry the King his son, have given full sworn assurance that aforesaid treaties shall be strictly observed by them in good faith and without any evil intent. And these are the witnesses: Richard, Bishop of Artrose, John, Dean of Salisbury, Robert, Abbot of Malmesbury, Ralph, Abbot of Monberg, Herbert, Archdeacon of Orme or Phantom, Walter of Costances, Roger, the King's Chaplain, Osbert, Clerk of the Chamber, Richard, son of the Lord King and Count of Poitou, Geoffrey, son of the Lord King and Count of Brittany, William, Earl of Essex, Hugh, Earl of Chester, Richard de Lohomet, the Constable, the Count of Meulan, Jordan Tesson, Humphrey de Moham, William of Courcy, the Seneschal, William, son of Alderhelm, the Seneschal, Alfred St. Martin, the Seneschal, and Gilbert Mallet, the Seneschal. Treaty signed at Fleurus. Well, hope you enjoyed reading that treaty. Apologies for any mispronunciations and me struggling to pronounce some names, but there you go. There's a treaty in its full extent. Feel free to look it up on Google if you want to view the full contents of this treaty. But yeah, that was a full reading of it. Thank you very much.